Welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 2nd, 2001, and this is a recording of Norm Moline titled The Environment, a Comprehensive Decision-Making Model. The tape number is MON 2001-1.
People who are running the tapes, my name is Norm Moline, and I teach on the faculty at Augustana College in Rock Island, and I'm a geographer, basically human geography, but all geographers have to have some background in natural sciences as well as the human. It's a discipline which sort of straddles divisions, so even on our campus, in fact, we're the only department where one leg is in the natural sciences, and students can take some of our courses for natural science credit, and then on the other side, they can take courses for social science credit. So that's a geographer, and as the week unfolds, you'll see that that's kind of the approach that we're taking here. We're talking about this week the environment, which is obviously a natural phenomenon, but other than tomorrow will be that these things sort of go together. I know people at Holden sort of plug in for one or another, but I thought I'd let you know sort of the way the series is going to unfold. You can pick and choose or come to this one, no more, or come to all of them as you wish. But other than tomorrow, when we'll be talking about natural processes, the main thrust of the discussion this week is how do we as people in society approach decisions about the environment, which therefore means it's mostly social science. And that's the course that I teach back on campus, land resources management. And a lot of the things have to do with things that aren't natural science. But one of the components is the natural processes. So what we're going to do tonight, probably, of the set, is maybe the one with the least involvement. Of course, questions will always be welcome. There are others where there will be more opportunity, I think, for discussion. Tonight we're just going to introduce a model that I was introduced to in graduate school 30 years ago and have found extremely useful, and it continues to show up in new forms now. Even the one book I'm going to be quoting from is a book that I purchased about a year ago and didn't have a chance to read, and so been reading it the last week or two, and I brought it along to finish it on the way out on the trip in here. And it turns out a lot of the very ideas which that author, which I'm going to be quoting, are the same essentially as this model that I learned 30 years ago. And so we'll introduce the model tonight, and then tomorrow, some of the sessions that my wife is handling fit into this. Tomorrow morning, I believe it is when we'll be talking about natural processes and an if-then approach. If you do this, you know something else is going to happen, so then you know that. And so then it's only a case of whether those changes, the then, is going to be serious or not. And so that's the theme tomorrow under the label The Closing Circle. In the morning, I'll be giving a few quick examples then and asking you to share some examples that you know, or anybody who's here tomorrow, from the natural world, where if you make one change, then these are known to be, scientifically known to be, the offshoots of that. Then later tomorrow night at this evening session, my wife will be talking about the old-growth forests of the Northwest. She's a biologist, and she'll be talking about that issue primarily from the ecology of the old-growth forests of the Northwest. So tomorrow's Natural Process Day. Then you, like me, take a break on the 4th of July, and then the next day when we come back, we'll be talking, in the first of the sessions, we'll be talking about how economics and geography, a spatial view is what we mean by geography, and Christianity, sort of may, a Christian ethic, may come to bear on how we make decisions about things. For example, the most obvious point, we'll be discussing at some length that night, both from the economic and the geographer perspective, and that is does it really make, when we say in the end, a project, if we do this, it's going to have negative impacts on somebody, at that point, then it becomes an ethical question. Do we really care whether it impacts somebody else? And economics or geography can't answer that, and that's where a value system or an ethical system will inform. Now, generally, probably most economists and most geographers would say if we're doing something here and it is going to have an impact on somebody else, we ought to include that in the analysis, which Christians would say, yes, that's where we should be worried about what we do and the impacts on others. But if one doesn't have a Christian value perspective, it may be, say, well, I know what I'm going to do here is going to have something negative on somebody else, but that's life. And so that's where we'll be talking about that kind of ethical issue on Thursday. My wife will pick up on that and use as an example that evening the drilling in the Arctic area, but of course the Anwar project, which is continues to be on the burner now and then. According to last week's paper, it's now off the table again, even by the Republican leadership in the House. But who knows, it could go back on the table again. And so whatever is going to happen, we thought that would be a good one to look at sort of as its impacts on others as an example. And then on Friday night, one of the last sessions, we'll be talking about the public right versus the public good versus private rights. And where is that line? And that to me is one of the most fascinating ones. And that's when you definitely will be involved. I've got about, 13 different case studies that are on a handout that you'll get. And we're not going to do all 13 of those, but we'll let you sort of give your answers and how you would respond to many of them, and then we'll see whether there's any consistency in your own decision-making, which I serve on a planning commission, and some of you may know, when we're having decisions about the environment, the one sure way to end up in the courts is if you treat this person one way and this person a different way. Because that person can say, how come you picked on me when you let this project go through? So at some point, decision makers, you, citizens, people who serve on commissions, somehow you need to develop some consistent rationale as to when you vote for protecting the public good, even if it means stepping on individuals' toes, or when does it become so important that you take the right of the private individual. That is a tough line. And just before I came in, I was spending a little bit of time just looking at Sunday's New York Times, and one of the last judgments by the Supreme Court last week, which we'll tell you about on Friday, it goes right to the core of this decision last week dealing with a Rhode Island wetland case, which the environmentalists so knew that the only place you're seeing it now is in the general paper, but within the next issues of the environmental magazines, they're going to be writing that this is a major defeat for the, a potentially major defeat for environmental protection, a 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court.
6-3.
Pardon?
6-3 was now, what I read.
The New York Times said 5-4.
Okay.
So that
Christian Science Monitor and 6-3.
Well, it will be interesting to see which is right then. So that's Friday night's discussion, and that's a good one for all of us, because whether you're a professional or simply a citizen, when you go for a public hearing and go to make a statement, sometimes you may be on the side of wanting to make sure you can do with your property as you wish, but then there may be other times when you go before and say, I don't want so-and-so doing that, because that's going to impact at me. So all of us, one way or another, if you haven't thought about it before, every one of us in the room is involved in where is that line? Because there is not an environment, this is a safe statement to me, there's not an environmental decision that is made where everybody wins. There's always somebody is going to lose, at least on the short term. And so where you and I place that margin, I find a fascinating topic, and that'll be Friday night. And Saturday morning, since we're leaving on the early one, they did squeeze this thing in at 9 o'clock, and then we'll be looking at a couple of approaches that after we go through all this, how do we approach decision-making? And you might end up at that point wondering, well, gee, what are the models? Are there any models out there that really can serve as guidelines for our decision? And at that point, I'm going to share two, but I'm going to invite whoever's here to bring up others. I plan that day to be talking only 15 minutes, 20 minutes out of the whole time, because at that point, certainly, there ought to be some good models that some of the rest of you have. The two I'll be citing, one by Ian McCarr called Design with Nature. I don't know, just out of curiosity, anybody read that or heard of that name? Okay, yeah, Ian McCarty. He wrote this book in the 60s. I was in grad school at the time when this book came called Design with Nature, and we thought it was great stuff. But there are a lot of things you read, and then pretty soon they get dated. That book, again, came out about 5 years ago. Once again, another reprinting of this book, Harvard, by Harvard University Press, with pictures to go with it, a coffee table thing. And it's so well known now that his name, McCarg, has become an adjective. And so you talk in terms of McCargian planning. The title of the book was Design with Nature. And then another person who influenced me greatly, and again, you think, okay, each of us have people that influence us greatly, but what's the impact at large? Another one who had a lot of impact on my line of thinking is Kevin Lynch, a person from MIT who died recently, and once again was cited as probably one of the three or four most important influential persons in urban planning in American history. So I felt a little bit reaffirmed that the people that I thought were neat have come to be perceived in their later. Ian McCarg also just died this spring. So within the last year and a half, two of these giants as to how the public approaches environmental issues have now passed on, but a legacy has been left. That'll be Saturday morning. So that's kind of the flow of things. Some case studies here and there. And we hope that there'll be a chance for you to toss your ideas certainly out and ask some questions. But to start, I want to introduce this model. One of the things and I'll give you a copy of this, actually. We have plenty of handouts. That's tough at holding, isn't it, to pass out handouts, because some of you are going to say, more trees are falling here. I pass those down. There are 30, so that should just about handle what's here. I must say, as I was thinking about this session, that I'm glad you're here. I mean, man, we're back at college. All we have to do worry about will people show up, whether they're going to sleep in or not. Here, the choice you had to still be hiking, to have gone to Rebecca Wee's poetry session earlier, which would have forced you to eat now, so to give up poetry, to give up a meal, to give up singing in the choir. Wow, I mean, you're a diehard environmentalist. I don't normally face such competition. And so I'm glad that you're here. Anyway, Gilbert White, we're going to end up just showing here in a short while a model by Gilbert White. Gilbert White is still alive. He is a geographer, lives just outside of Boulder. He was at University of Chicago when I was there. Gilbert White also, I thought he was a terrific person, but he received one of the Presidential National Science Awards last year at the White House, honored because of his work for 70 years. He's now 89 and still traveling around the world advising governments on water and land policies. Gilbert White, when he introduced his ideas in grad school, he first drew upon this model, which he said had influenced him. So this goes back even earlier. This was a book by Walter Fiery. It comes from a book by Walter Fiery called Man, Mind, and Land. And that Walter Fiery in the 60s was saying, late 50s was when he wrote this book, he said, if you imagine this square, this box, of all the potential decisions that could be made on any topic. And by the way, some of you are saying, well, I'm not a decision maker. No, every one of you is a decision maker, whether it's your own property or whether you have something to say in your community. So, and that's what this was aimed at. So as each one of us are involved in one way or another at making decisions, how should we look at them? Well, Fiery said, imagine all of these dots then as possible decisions. Now, he said some of those, though, are really not going to be very good for the natural environment. And so we have the circle P here, begins on the outside. Of all the decisions related to some aspect of the environment that you and I could make, only a few of those dots are going to be compatible with natural processes. So the environmental scientists would say that eliminates all the rest of them outside of this P circle. Well, then another set, if we jump down here to this one, some decisions are only some possible decisions are really acceptable within a culture. All right, and that's the C circle. It goes here. Now, just to give, there are probably all kinds of examples that could be given. One that's an easy one, we could say one way to increase some of the meat production in the United States would be to herd some dogs. And we'll have some dog-raising operations. Plenty of dogs, they reproduce quickly. Quickly would provide a nice supply of protein into our diet. So why don't we increase dog production in the U.S.? Well, in the U.S., that's going to be a dot. Oh, it might be okay environmentally, but it's outside sea. Our culture simply is not good for that. And we could go on with all kinds of these. In some societies, it may be, for example, a cultural no-no to actually dig into the ground and create irrigation. That was one problem with some of the Native American cultures, because if the earth is our mother, if God is in the earth, rather than we might perceive in the heavens, to actually put plow in and to dig up the earth and to do certain things might in some Native American groups been perceived as culturally unacceptable. Okay, now that would tell right off then, and this book that I've just been reading again says that at the core of environmental decision making, you and I have to find things that meet both of those if we're going to be realistic. The naturalist, environmentalist would say, well, as long as it's in P, it's okay. But that's going to put some things over here which simply won't fit the culture. And you can say, well, why don't we change the culture? That may be harder to do than we might think. So the goal now then would be to go for the A's, the set of resource processes which are adoptable. That is, they could be adoptable, anything within here, because they are acceptable to the culture and they're not going to mess up the environment. So we have to find somehow those dots. But then within that circle, Fiery said, some of the things that a culture likes to do, they're not really very economical. And economical used in the broadest sense of the word. So as a subset of C, Walter Fiery proposed this, the set of resource processes which are efficient, economically efficient for the members of a given population. So that's a narrower group. Now if we're then going to say within here, now we're down to this zone. And now we begin to see the bottom half of the diagram a little bit better. We're really talking now about the decisions that there are, according to this diagram, about six dots that are in there. Economically gainful, culturally adaptable, and natural process sustainable and unharmful. Walter Fiery, in this initial model, put a little extra section on this beyond what would be the economic component here, saying that there are some things. This one, it actually is L. It's actually clearer to understand this as X prime. The resource practices which have the property of appearing to the user as being more likely to be performed by other people in a given area. And this is where the idea of environmental perception comes in. And here an example that I know is the case in particular some kinds of soil conservation projects. Some farmers, even if you would say if you adopt this particular practice, this is a good practice, it fits our culture, certainly it's economical, but it may or may not be economical, and it's compatible with the environment, they may say, I'm not sure about that, because the neighbors down the way aren't using it. I don't want to be the first person to try out this technique. Conversely, there may be some things you're not sure yourself whether it's economical, and maybe it isn't economical, but down the way, there are several farmers down the road who are already doing this, and if they're doing this, it probably is okay. And there's some of that decision in which goes on, which is to say this little extra part here, without worrying about the difference between L and X prime, the idea of that was that there are some people, some decisions which you may make. They're culturally acceptable. They may or may not be economically gainful, but you do them because other people are doing it already. Now, this was Fiery's model. I guess I won't take questions on that for now, because what really counts is what did Gilbert Wright then say about this? And here's, I have only three handouts, so don't worry, we're not going to have too many. Gilbert White saw this, and obviously it prompted him in his thinking to want to share it with us as grad students. Again, I almost hesitate because some of you may say, geez, he's using the model that's 40 years old. But again, you'll be seeing in a second that some of the 1990s texts that come out still keep coming back to the Gilbert White model, at least among the geographers. The first paragraph is the one I want to read sort of with it, read it with you together here. A broad problem in resource management is explaining why resource use differs from place to place. We are not concerned here with the larger questions of why a particular farming localizes in a given region or why urban use concentrates in a particular river valley. We are asking why a particular course of action is chosen among those possible, all of the dots in our previous diagram, all of these dots, why among all the dots that are out there is a particular course chosen? And why is this choice different from choices made in other places with similar environments? I guess maybe Gertrude is the only one who knows me or sees how I operate, and many people know me. Within geography, there, environmental determinism is a concept which has been gone for 75 years. Many people who aren't geographers think, oh yeah, it's important to understand the geography, and they mean the landforms or soils of a region, because that will influence human activity. Geographers tossed that out as a way of looking at the world about 75 years ago. We asked the question, what is the relationship between people and the environment? But we don't assume that the environment determines human activity, because there are so many examples that will refute that. What really influences human uses of the environment in places most of the time is the background of their culture. And so in this case, what we're saying is, Gilbert White, why is the choice about how to use a resource so different even from people who are living in similar environments? And then the answers can come only in a framework of decision which includes economic efficiency but is not restricted to it. Some of you may recall, but at that point when he was emphasizing this in the late 60s, a lot of the decisions, as they still often are influenced, should we decide this? Let's check the benefits, let's check the costs, and bottom line, we'll decide it. So therefore, just turn your decision-making over to the economists. Whichever one will turn out the best benefit-cost ratio, that's what you decide. He was saying, we gotta include economics, but let's not restrict it. In much the same way here, that he was saying this is not only an economic choice, otherwise there are some economic things that are over here, fault or fire, saying that, and Gilbert White was saying it. Efficiency criteria are important, and in a free market society, having full information, full use of available technology, and keen recognition of the social consequences, they might be expected to reveal a major part of the process. But in a society where much investment judgment is guided by value criteria, set by public constraints, where neither individuals nor public agencies ordinarily act with full information on available knowledge as to the resources and technology, and where the less tangible and direct linkages with resource use elsewhere are ignored, we have to have a broader framework of decision making. And at that point, he proposed, and this is simply a model, I don't think he ever intended this as a model to be sort of circulated widely. He was recommending it to us, as others have used it since, as a way of looking at the environment. And so this is the model we're going to be following a little bit off and on all week. And these are the variables. The decision, whoever is involved in this, the decision is going to be influenced by these variables. And first is the matter of perception. And I'm going to come back and spend some more time on that as we get going. But that's, notice, perception, how people see things is going to influence everything in the model. And I'll give you some examples of that. So the perception of, and then the things that one will go into this are, what are the range of choices? Anybody who's trying to make a decision, the environment, what are the range of choices out there to help me solve this problem? How can I have better soil conservation? Or what would be a better method of managing this forest resource? Or what would be a better method of dealing with wetlands, or floodplains, or urban parks, or you name it? What is the range of choice that is in the mind of the decision maker? And now the goal, if one of White, by the way, used this model as a way of analyzing past decisions, myself and others who have followed after him feel it becomes a good model to guide our future decisions. So on this variable, one of the things that we would push throughout here is you like to have in front of you the widest range of choices. And for that, obviously, people who have read, who have traveled, who have seen things, they're likely to have perceived, they're likely to know about more ways to solve this problem than somebody who is less educated in a poor country of the world or someplace where they simply don't know where. How do I solve this problem? The only way I know how is this way. Ideally, the goal would be to somehow stretch the range of choices. And let's say then, if I didn't draw, but if we can imagine a matrix, have each of these down the left-hand side, and then at the top we have our choices. Choice 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way to N. As we look at those choices, then we're going to analyze them in terms of these five. What are the natural processes? If we decide to do this, what will be the impact on natural processes? If we decide to do this, do we have the technology available to do it? If we decide to do this, what will be the economics of the decision? If we decide to do this, and this is where White made sure we add in spatial linkages, which is really the geography. What is the impact of this action? What is the link between that on another place? And if we do that, what does the law say about it? And so you use this as the decision-making framework. And if you have this in a matrix, as I said, ideally, let's say we're going to simply use plus or minus or neutral, a zero for neutral, or an N, however, whatever you want to do it. And so if we have choice number one, then we're going to look at it. Choice number one, does it satisfactory for natural process? That's okay. So that's a yes or a plus. Is that okay? Do we have the technology to do that? Yes. Economically, no. Okay, then we won't have to maybe go too much further or keep going. Spatial linkages, no negative effects there, but it's against the law. So that gets a minus. So choice A is not a very good choice. Choice two, let's check that one out. And so you get the picture. You simply analyze, you try to get as wide a range of choices in front of you, and then you conduct your analysis according to these remaining five variables and to see whether or not you're going to get a plus or a minus, or no reaction to it. And the ideal in the end is you're going to look down all of those and which of them have the five pluses. And that way it has basically done what Walter Fiery said in here, and that is it's going to be culturally adaptable, it's going to be environmentally possible, and it's going to be economically efficient, and it's going to be perceived as okay by your neighbors.
In those five variables, where would the impact on social processes fall?
That would mostly come in here. Values, norms, those kinds of things are going to come here. This would also be involved because if you do something here and the air pollution now is going to blow across the river or down the way to somebody else, should we care about that? Or if we put, as somebody proposed in Rock Island once, this morning Paul Olson was talking about environmental, the African-American minority situation in the U.S. and in Rock Island, there was a proposal to put a toxic waste recycling facility. Pretty good idea. I mean, to do that, you need something like that to take care of paints and turpentines and so on. Where did they propose to put it? They argued it was next to the expressway, but next to the expressway also was the predominantly African-American community. And so at that point, the spatial impact of that on the neighborhood was so negative, everybody said, you can't talk about doing that. And so the proposer quickly got that off the table. So that would have been a social impact. In that case, it would fall here. The impact on that property impacting on those next door. Yeah, question?
You mentioned something being against the law. Couldn't that be kind of an overriding thing that would negate everything else if something was
it's a good way. When Gilbert White proposed this model, my lecture notes from grad school, it has the SG outside of this. But students convinced me to put it in there because it's your choice to decide whether you want to obey the law or not.
Or whether you want to work to change the law.
That's right, yeah. And so sort of the environment, like the fellow in the sermon last night was saying, somebody who's so anti-nuclear weapons, simply take the hands. I don't care what the law is, I'll get arrested and I'll do that. So that's why students convinced me We ought to put that inside too, because even there, perception is something that ought to go into it. But you were right where Gilbert White was. I know he changed his view on that as well. You understand the general framework of the model? Let me give some examples of perception. First, as we think about that, and I think you know what perception is. Sometimes students aren't as aware of it, but I think you do. And we begin with the idea on perception that I think all of us in the room would know, that there's not a person around who's objective. Not any of us are. And so therefore, every decision, every person is going to have a different view. And as we'll see in a few minutes when we talk about how to measure perception, very difficult to measure. But one of the things that I try to get across to students when we spend a whole day simply talking about the perception is to realize that their view is only their view. And that even everybody else around the room is going to have a different perception about that. Always is different from the objective. All of us like to think we have an objective view, but none of us do. So what is our perception? Perception is a combination of our physical senses and our mental background and impressions of places. So, I mean, you can imagine some of the kinds of things that are going to influence how people think about things. First would be physiological capabilities. Some in this room have probably fantastic eyesight. Others maybe have problems. Some may be colorblind. Some may have fantastic hearing qualities. Others may have deficiencies. And on we can go through. Every one of us is physiologically a little different. And so how we see a natural resource, a lake, a wetland, a forest, a farm, that partly is going to be influenced by our very physiological capabilities and traits. Gender. We're learning. Gender makes a difference. What some people may think about an issue may have a very different perspective from the other gender. Age, education. I think in class we'd have to give more examples, but you're smart enough, you can see how all of these would make a difference. People's educational levels certainly are going to influence decisions. One of the interesting things that they found in the studies about the impact of education is that the more education that people have, the more willing they are to say, I don't know. We don't know the answer to that. It turns out that's one of the main end results of education. People who don't have as much education somehow feel more inclined that there must be an answer. And so therefore they'll grab on someone else's answer, or they'll plug in their own, rather than to simply say, that's a tough question, and we're just going to have to live with uncertainty for that. For the ability to live with uncertainty seems to grow the more educated you have, or at least once you reach a good high school plus level of education. So that's going to influence perception. For example, here I will give one that we work on in the Quad Cities in Illinois on the Mississippi River. On the Mississippi is floodplains. Educated folks can understand when we say there's a 100-year flood, a 1% probability. And most educated folks, okay, they know that's a probability, and that means you don't know what's going to happen next year. You know that over the long haul, it's maybe only likely to occur once in 100 years. But you could end up with four of those in a row and then have none for 400 years. People can understand the notion of that. Some people can, but a lot of people don't. Now, when we've done floodplain studies in the Quad Cities like this, we ran about 7 or 8 of them, and every time we came up with about 75% of the public could accept that reality. We're just not sure from year to year whether the Mississippi's going to flood. We know what variables are going to go into that, but we can't predict for sure ahead of time. The other 25%, though, had such notions as it flooded last year. They said it was a 100-year flood. I'm already 38 or 47 or 62. I'm not going to have another one of those because it's going to be 100 years away. So then they influence their decision makers that way. Or they think floods come in clusters. That's another one we found often. We're in a period now in which we're going to get a lot of floods. Meteorologists will say we really don't know that. But repeatedly, we would do that. And so that meant that in our particular area, about 25% of the public is not educated enough to know when we talk about probabilities, it means just that. You can't tell next year, we can only tell over a long haul. So education, occupation, it makes a difference. Out here, I know that one of the big differences in these states, since you could give this lecture, huh? The difference between a person who's a lumberman and counting on the forest to provide income for the family is going to have a very different attitude toward decisions about these forests than the urban computer specialist in Seattle or Portland who loves going into the forests occasionally for some nice weekend activities. Think how that is going to change the perception of what to do with the forests out here. Think of how we add into that, think of not only the lumberman or the urban computer specialist, but the Norm Orleans who come out to Washington once every 7 years and feel that it's great the United States has a section like the Pacific Northwest. So I should have maybe my perception of the Northwest. And of course, I only come in the summer. So the Pacific Northwest is always blue. Fantastic weather, the trees are here. By golly, keep that place as it is. Now think about that. That's different from even those of you who are Washingtonians, whichever the side of the fence you're on. I'm a visitor, and you may say, my opinion doesn't count. We're going to run our own state. I would say it's part of the natural resources, so therefore my perception should count in the decisions made in Washington. Now, some of you may boo me out of the room at that point, but that's what we're getting at here. Occupation, past experiences. Often travel is an experience. People who have had a wider range of experiences are going to take quite a different view of perceiving things. The income, and the income of a family and the needs. Again, we could go back to the earlier one. Many people are dependent upon the environment for their main source of income. The perceptions of that environment are going to be very different from those who are only coming occasionally. Beyond that, you can talk about, they have found distinctions between income levels. People who are just barely putting food on the table, they may not even be concerned about the environment. It may show up number 16 out of 16 issues if a congressman or someone sends a note around, what are you concerned about in life? They may be putting environmental quality down pretty low because they're concerned about food and about housing and about jobs. And so this is an interesting issue that we'll get to later in the week, how the difference between middle and upper income people, who often, according to some of the sociological terms, are more inclined to be dealing with what are called higher order needs, a nice place to have an aesthetic experience, appreciation of beauty, a sense to experience the wonder of nature. We can do that because we have bread on the table, and we've got housing and we've got jobs. For people who aren't there, they're going to have very different perceptions. And then the question becomes, whose perception counts? That I want to come back to in a few minutes, and then again, we'll get some of your input. The role in society. The role in society. There is a nice section in this book, which I just uncovered, and I'd like to read it, because I think it puts in context I do serve on the Planning Commission in our town, and we always try to remember this. Design has to do with the quality of experience in environments. Ultimately, each person's vision is compounded from what that person sees and experiences daily, weekly, monthly, annually, or occasionally. The vision is also affected by people's assumptions about their power to influence urban environmental quality. Many, perhaps a majority, feel helpless. Others, stronger or better off materially, survive and enjoy the environment's better aspects. A few expand further into various kinds of political or cultural activity that gives them at least the illusion of influencing or impact the form and character of the environment. At the top, of course, are the people of the power structure, decision makers who have substantial or major impact on the form of the environment, and whose consciences must be their guides. So again, what do people perceive as their role in society? One of the things we find on this is to get people to come to a hearing, trying to tell them that everybody's opinion in this city of Rock Island, 38,000, everybody's opinion counts. And many of them say, oh, it's no use. I know who's going to make the decisions. That's what you can see then when you make a decision, how the perception is going to vary between some people and others. Values. There are many, many values that could influence people's perceptions. I suspect Holden, probably everybody here, or many would bring what we would say a Christian value orientation to this decision. But in America, in democracy, where all values are sort of accepted, there are going to be some who don't have that perception at all. And that has to be included. Psychological attitude. All of us, I think, have had places where you, times when you go to one site on one date, when you're feeling good, and wow, this is the most terrific place around. And then you go back to that place, and something's changed, and it's no longer the same place. We've got a very sick uncle at home now, Janet's uncle, and he lost his wife a year ago. He always loved to go to Florida. He would go to Florida, and he and his wife would have a great time for a couple of weeks or a couple of months in the winter. Well, he lost his wife last summer, and he went down this past winter. And the people who see him right now, he may not survive our stay out here in the Northwest, but people who, some speculation is that once he got back from Florida, it wasn't the same. And probably he went to Florida, and Florida didn't look as nice because of changed psychological situation that he was in. But it can also be generally a psychological attitude about, are some people just generally feeling that the environment is maybe not important, or there's no hope in finding the solutions to what I'm looking for in life in that situation. Finally, the context of the decision. Here are the best example I can give. It's a nice one in the West. It doesn't relate direct resource management, but it shows the context. The writers about crossing the American Great Plains, once they left our state to go west, many of them admitted this is a tough time. I mean, it gets, as you know, gets drier and drier and drier. And those who were planning on leaving Illinois and maybe stopping in Iowa or maybe in Nebraska or Kansas, they often would raise difficult questions, except the Mormons. And so think of their decision. I mean, they knew they were already going. When they finally left Illinois, they knew they had a place to go to on the other side. For them, this is a journey. We just have to get through it in the next week or so, and then we're at the promised land. And so often their descriptions of the Great Plains were not nearly as negative. The context of their perception, those who were thinking, gee, do I really want to put a house here and stay here forever? That's a very different one. The context of the decision, one that when we talk about this in class, that students often bring up, is I would vote in certain ways, except if I knew this was the last one, then my decision on that issue would be different. If I knew this is the last of such and such in this county, whether it be a natural resource or the last round barn in the county, the context of the decision. Well, I think you can see how this shows up. Another really neat article, which I didn't bring along, but if anybody wants, you know, give me your address, I'll send it to you. It was written by a geographer, Donald Meinig, about 20 years ago, 10 versions of the same scene. And Meinig said, he showed how that when you look at a scene, when you take a cross-section of people and you show a slide or something, some people will automatically see it as environmental problem. Some will see it as environmental history. I wonder how that has changed over time. Probably the person who's in charge of the taping here, the historian, he would probably take that view. Some will automatically see it as natural process. Some will automatically see it as artifact, a creation of the human presence in this place for a long time. Some will see it as opportunity. Wow, is that a good place? I can see a housing development going in over there. I can see something else going in. Some would see it aesthetic. Golly, that's beautiful. And others would see it as place. That's a nice spot where the human activity and the natural stuff simply makes it a nice place. I'd like to live there. And others would see it as ideology. That would only happen in America. When I take students to Asia, they will automatically, they'll take that picture and then they'll come and show it and say, this is what would happen in a communist society. We say, there's nothing communist in that at all. But they brought an idea to that. Perception influences everything. Now, let's just show how that influences these. The range of choices that are out there, we've already indicated. People's, it is not only what's out there which tells us the range of choice, but it's what the decision makers have in their heads that will influence what they see as choices. So that means we can't just be natural scientists and study what's out there. We have to somehow begin to ask about what are the nature of the decision makers? What kind of background are they bringing into this decision situation? Perception of natural processes. We can have the scientists who will tell us exactly what the natural processes are, but again, I already gave you the flood example. Some people simply will think they're perceiving natural processes coming, floods coming in clusters, or they come once every 100 years. People's perception of natural processes, really, all of us have some accurate, but often some inaccurate perceptions. You hope that natural scientists are closest to being objective, but not always the case. Perception of technology is an interesting one. First, is it there? That one you would have all guessed. But then comes the other part of perception, and some people maybe would say, I could tell you, we have the technology to make such and such a decision. And some of you would say, well, then why don't we go ahead with it? Society, American society, showing that technology will work. Some of you would say, in my life, I've seen enough situations where they said the technology will work. Don't tell me that the technology is all okay. So among this room, we probably have a range of perceptions on whether you trust a plus mark for technology in this formula. So perception of that is there. Economics. Okay, you could say let's run as objective as an economic analysis as possible, and we'll finally find out the benefit and cost, and this is going to end up being a situation where there's a modest gain, let's say a 4% gain from our investment to what we're getting out of this natural resource project, putting in a toll wall, a terrace in an agricultural area, putting in a dam on a pond, something that comes out with at least a 4 or 5% return. Now we get the perception, huh? Some of you would say, 4 or 5% in this day and age? Well, now this year it's different. Now this year we'd probably take it. 2 years ago, 4 or 5%, you might as well toss your money in the ocean if you're only making 4 or 5%. So now we get the perception of what is economically efficient. Probably there are some in this room who would say, for economically efficient, if I'm doing some good, all I need to do is to make sure that ends meet. And then if by my resource action, I'm helping the environment as long as I'm still able to function. That's okay with me. And others would say, no, don't ask me as a landowner to do that if that's the sacrifice. So that, and here's an example that comes in. A Harvard economist came up with the idea of satisficing. Maybe any of you know this concept, maybe not. And the example, it's that you don't know in the end of all the choices. You can't be sure exactly what will be perfect and what will be the best fit. So finally, you just say, among the alternatives in front of us, this one seems to be the most economically efficient. And the example that we use that I remember, I heard it in grad schools, keep using it, and that is when we finally, sorry, Jan, about this, but when we finally select our spouse, and we say, you're the one and only. Now, do you really know out of 6 billion people on the planet that you found the right one? No, it simply means of the alternatives available to you at a given point, this seemed to be the best match. And the students at this point, just like you, you know, they're ready to toss darts. How can you be so insensitive to your spouse? And that kind of thing. But what the example is that we finally, all of us, make, when we see all the economic alternatives in front of us, we finally have to say, this one will satisfy what my needs are economically. That will be, by my perception, as being efficient.
But don't you have another question with economics as to what is going to be the equation in terms of benefits and costs?
Exactly. Huge question. Of what will actually be counted in benefits and costs. And on that point, that's one reason why Gilbert White decided to add the spatial linkages. If you really would do benefit cost very well, and it turns out, again, I can use this example because we're right in Washington, but whether or not a farmer in western Michigan should invest in a certain way in growing apples, that will impact, possibly, the apple growers in Washington. Now, are you going to include the potential loss to apple growers in Washington in the benefit-cost analysis for Farmer Jones in Western Washington, who's deciding whether or not I should grow apples? Probably not. And you can't, and most economists would say at some point you have to set some kind of limits. And that's where Gilbert White said, we admit that. For practicality to get the economic decisions done, let's let the economists do and work within the area they're comfortable with, but let's make sure then that we ask at some other point in our decision, what will be the impact of our actions here on people elsewhere? But that's a good point, and we'll talk a little bit of that on the economics day. Finally, the last two, and that is this one. What are the spatial linkages? Again, we would hope the geographers and the scientists would be able to say, if we dam a river here, it is going to have impact down there. If we build this terrace here, that will affect not only this farmer, but it will affect, we hope we can do that. But then the perception question on that will become, as I indicated at the beginning, and this is what we'll come to in a session later, I mean, should that make a difference? I mean, if I'm Farmer Jones, or Landowner Jones, I may have to run this analysis and finally just end up saying, I know this is going to have some negative impact on others, but I got to do what I got to do. And so now it becomes then a perception case whether the spatial linkages are important, and that's right into our value system. And the last one we've already dealt with. What are the laws that are out there? And on this one, I give you a handout just for the fun of it to show that some of you, again, this is different with many of the students, who of course are just getting into this. But when we think of all the laws that are out there, which you're getting, and I thought this one I'd give to you as a handout, it really is a fascinating, this is the major list of some significant federal legislation. This is only the federal. You could add to that all the local ones, but all of these laws. So if you and I want to make any decision about the environment now, we're going to have to know some of these. As one person spoke on our campus, a person who works for the state of Illinois, he said, if you can tell your students one thing, whatever one of these things they're going into, if it's wetlands, know the ins and outs of the wetland program. If they're going into toxic substances, make sure they know the ins of that, or not teach it all day by day, but that they know when they go into that job. They ought to know backward and forward the key legislation that affects this. Because who knows when the question is going to come up, and if you have to say, well, I'm going to have to go check on that. Your credibility goes down if you're particularly a 23 or 25-year-old, just moved, somebody asks a question, you say, you know, I've already looked at that, and if you follow that up and look at two sections later in the law, you'll see that what you said is not really correct. The person sort of sheepishly goes back down, and somebody else, so you can whip your audience in a good sense if you have facts now. So they said, know those laws. And that's the knowledge of that. That's the professional's perception. Obviously, the individual's perceptions are going to be a little different from that. The average citizen, they may not know the details. Then it becomes the task of the person to try and work with them and clarify that. Plus, then the point that you raised in your earlier question about whether or not this should be in or outside the parentheses, the perception is, okay, so we have the laws. Maybe we don't like the laws, so let's either disobey them or let's do everything in our power to change them, whether by normal channels or by protest. We're simply not going to follow these. We're not going to tolerate that kind of a law anymore. And so that becomes a perception.
In looking at your list of laws, for those of us out west, the Federal Mining Act of about 1872 is a huge...
Oh, yeah, that should go right. This is only a part of it. Thank you. We should add more. Exactly. Yes, please.
One of the thoughts I had listening to all this is that all of us are involved right here at Holden in all of these processes with our sewer system. Psychologically, if we can take a 30-second shower and, you know, lather up and then turn that little button and turn it off, whether we can tolerate if it's yellow, let it mellow, and if it's brown, flush it down. The laws that regard the drain fields that are so sensitive, and we had to have 10-yard spaces between trees and then bare spots and trees, and has to be away from the road, and all of these things, every one of them had to go into our decisions and then our individual responses to how we live in this sewer system we have. Where they put the septic tanks. It's kind of cool stuff.
Right. We use, even it turns out in our community, one of the issues is burning of leaves. and we still allow it in our town. Jim and I and a lot of other people aren't real happy with it. But we say, okay, if you're in a community that allows that, the students or others who may think, there's no decision, I don't see how this model fits with what I'm thinking about, we say at least, okay, you maybe can change the law, but maybe the day if you are going to burn, burn on the day when the smoke's going right to your own house. Consciously pay attention so that the day you burn leaves, the wind is going right to your own house, not the day it's going to your neighbors. I'm not sure many of us see many neighbors who burn leaves on the day when it's going right into their own porch. And so that would be one of these cases where even in the most innocent of simple kinds of decisions where you and I can maybe use this model. So this isn't intended just for professionals. Other questions? We only have a couple minutes left here today, but any questions or other examples somebody wants to toss out?
For us on the West, the other issue that I think we really need to be on this list is the Water Rights Act. Probably the issue of water rights in the West is probably creating more animosity and more anger than perhaps any other federal act.
You're thinking of the Clean Water Act, or you're going back to the 19th century, the prior appropriation?
Prior appropriation.
Yeah, okay. Right.
First in line with first question.
In case, yeah, that's if those, most of you are from the West, if you aren't, if you're from Minnesota or Illinois, if you haven't heard from that back home in the eastern part of the United States, it's called riparian water law. If you live next to a river, you have the right to use it. So proximity, riparian, gives you to use it. Once you get into sort of Nebraska, Kansas, it starts to change. And from there west, certainly in the core mountain states, it's prior appropriation. That is who got there first. And one of my colleagues from grad school, actually, even as late as 1970, he was hired by the state of South Dakota to be the one who goes back and says, you got your law in May of 1878, and you got yours in July of 1878, so you're right, you came first, so you get the water, and you're out of luck. 100 years later, his job was still to go there and to go back through the records and to see who got the laws first. So exactly, thank you for bringing that up. That's a huge one in the West. Well, as a closing statement, again, coincidentally, I had other quotes that I was going to read out of this, but I found it interesting to look at this particular book to see what it was that people, to see whether he was saying some of the same things, but he ends up with, he suggests right at the beginning, a nice statement. In talking about this sort of decision-making framework, with the environmentalists, this is the fellow, Garrett Ekbo, is the head of landscape architecture program at Berkeley for many years, and he and some colleagues wrote this book, People in Landscape, in the late 1990s, 1998. He says here, we share a worldview. The future will be determined by the kinds of relations that develop between the world of nature and the world of human culture. The decisive factor will be the vision of environmental change found in the great traditions of architecture, landscape, art, literature, music, and design. Their processes are capable of digesting history and current world experience and visualizing where the world can go and how it can find its way. And in another portion, he talks about how whether this is really an optimistic conclusion. I believe this is the final quote, in which he's talking about how we can be optimistic about this. Now, I guess I don't have it here. I thought I had, yes, here it is, page 81. On any basis, from culture to survival, it is apparent that these two lines, culture and nature, have to reconnect. Again, that's the two overlapping circles to go back to Fiery. That culture and nature have to reconnect in some way. Is it possible to conceive of human culture in the 21st century remarrying nature and producing a new revitalized family of truly integrated design? Design, by the way, for him, has a lot of human involvement. This isn't Sierra Club. Stay back and let the wilderness be. design is very much involved. Is it truly possible to conceive of human culture mirroring nature and producing a new revitalized family of truly integrated designed natural environments? We would not be writing this if we did not think that the answer was yes. We are irreversible optimists in the central areas of human vision and cultural flexibility. So I think that's what White, and here he is, this 89-year-old person who still is an inspiration to a lot of us, says, if we begin to look at things in this kind of a matrix, which includes both natural and realistic human issues, economics and culture and people's perceptions and the rest, maybe we can come up with solutions that are within, to go back to the fiery model, that are within that inner circle. It's not going to be easy, of course, to do that, but he says that's the realistic way to go about it. Rather than just saying, we got to save this, and we got to save that, and we got to save that, and we got to save that, and finally people say, yeah, but we do have 6 billion and counting people in the world, and so somehow we got to match the two up, and that's what he's hoping, that somehow we can find those pluses. And it really is a way we try to get across to students that doesn't negate the role of natural scientists or economists at all. So I hope you walk away with that. The natural scientists and the economists are very much a part of this process, but so are some other things.
Social guidance you've talked about in terms of a law, that also has to include people's values and philosophical points of view, religion, etc.
Exactly, it is. It's the law, and right, I'm thinking, I didn't include that, but that's right. It includes both the official law and simply what society wants, the values, the perspectives of the group. Yes, please.
These balances aren't always equally weighted. No. We are in this county right here where we are facing decisions that are driven by laws which give enormous weight to some vectors and virtually ignore others. For example, what's being done with our dams right here within a few miles of here relating to fish survival. The latest economic analysis, it will cost $3 million per fish to implement. And that's not a concern, because the law mandates what has to be done. So the balancing isn't always as fair, let's say, as one would hope.
Yeah, and that's where, of course, then what is the balance? And you can see, and then you get into it. Some have argued that for so long, this has been the one. And now, in some cases where it comes up, then others would say maybe some of this goes too far, and then it creates a backlash. And so, anyway, yes, please.
Either in this or in that first model that you presented, does the economics of the situation ever take into consideration the negative externalities?
Yes.
That is considered in?
It is, and that's what would come again under economics or spatial linkages. Because often the economic analysis, it gets complicated, you get into those externalities. And so that's where White, who did a lot of his work with economists, that's one reason why he seems to sort of feel comfortable in including that in a diagram, which a lot of people in the 60s in the key environmental movement, they were saying, oh, economists, they're over there and we're the natural scientists. But he worked with them through an organization called Resources for the Future. It's not an organization you and I can join, but a real sort of multidisciplinary environmental think tank in Washington. And that's where the economists said, oh, and I know they told him, Gilbert, it's so hard for us to include all the externalities. And White said, okay, that's true. Economists are trained to do their analysis best within the parameters of their discipline. But there ought to be other ways in which we ought to ask the question, okay, this is an economically right decision, but if we do that, it really is going to have some bad impacts on the neighbors. And that may end up overruling. It doesn't say it's not economic, but it says simply it's not one of those that's acceptable. It's something that's very hard to prove, but it just, in principle, we believe we can't do that if it's going to have the impact on the neighbors. Now, if you really do, some economists, and one that I'm going to cite a little bit in the session on Thursday, we use it in class, Peskin and Seskin, they say, in fact, the economists should do as best they can to incorporate into the analysis the externalities. Nevertheless, you're right. I took a course, a refresher course, 3 years ago on microeconomics. I guess it's 5 years ago now, so I sat in on it. And it was microeconomics, a full term. and I had to head out of town for some other, it was on a sabbatical term, in week 9 of the term, and they hadn't got to externalities yet, and that's the way the text was written. I mean, it mentions it, but how do you actually incorporate externalities into the microeconomics analysis? It tends to come up near the end of the term, and so partly what you're saying, that's why White said, okay, that's the way it goes, so let's include it under spatial linkages.
And the cost-benefit analysis model is inherently biased against the benefits. I mean, what is the benefit to me of seeing Mountain Near clear from smog? If someone tries to reduce that to, is it worth $50 to me and times a million people, so that's 50 million, or is it 5 billion?
Exactly.
Whereas it's very easy to measure the cost, particularly the cost within the firm. So they always tend to sort of tag that stuff at the end. Even worse than the externality sort of gets tagged out at the end, and then the non-measurable benefits. What's my life worth?
Yeah. Well, one of the lessons at Holden is we can't run on the best practice. So thank you for coming. I hope you'll come back to some of these sessions where you can plug them in, check the schedule, and you'll at least know what the flow of this is about.